From the age of 5 to 15, I was raised in Idaho Falls, Idaho. My family attended the only Episcopal church in the town, St. John's. We were an amazingly strong congregation. We even had our very own paid priest, unlike many of the other churches in a state full of Latter-day Saints. Just saying. As more and more people came to work at the National Reactor Testing Station, the town began to grow, and surprisingly, so did our membership. We had a precious 60-year-old church built in 1909. You guys can do the math. Painted red and white with a fabulous bell tower. That wee little building could almost seat 75 people if we had all of our winter coats on, and in the summer could swell up to 100. We were already having two services each Sunday, so the discussion began, should we have a third? Well, it was decided, no, we would tear down this precious little church and build a new one so that we could all sit together at one time. We began the process of fundraising. Does this sound familiar? Just wondering. I remember participating in a fabulous fundraiser of a Shrove Tuesday pancake breakfast. It's actually a supper, I think, for Mardi Gras. The parents would cook, and the children were the servers. The teenagers got to take the orders and bring the food and pour the coffee. Us littler ones were the table cleaners and the ones setting for the next person. Then we began selling parts of the church. No, not the old one, but you could buy or sponsor a given piece, like a new pew, a glass window, a door handle. As kids were enlisted to sell these items, it's kind of like sticking those little Girl Scouts out in front of the grocery store selling those little cookies. Nobody could resist us. We would make bricks in Sunday school to sell to the parents. You could buy one for a quarter or five for a dollar. Okay, quarters went further back then. We had holiday craft fairs and auctions, certainly not one as fancy as here at UUSS. The entire congregation pulled together like a team of Clydesdales, creating beautiful items to raise more funds. We worked and worked with every heart and mind focused on building a new edifice. From the groundbreaking ceremony to the blessing and opening of the doors, we worked tirelessly for our new spiritual home. From this new and expanded space, the congregation was able to take on more public service, such as offering a soup kitchen for those in need, sponsoring a non-Mormon Boy Scout troop, opening a thrift shop, and offering services to the Native American tribes and migrant workers. I am so lucky to have been a part of that work at the age of 10. The experience has served me well over the years. I learned that being of service is much more satisfying to me than to the one who receives it. Best of all, I know that a group of like-minded people can come together to support a cause and move it to successful completion. Now, all these years later, here I am again in a newly built, beautiful church with a congregation much like the one back in Idaho, who pull together to bring together a beautiful house of worship. I enjoy our participation each Sunday morning and extra activities such as my Saturday Stitchers, serving coffee and treats to the service of the Sheriff's Community Service Team that helps keep our grounds beautiful, and attending classes and working on annual service auctions. I adore being a part of this community with all of you.
In our monthly sermon series about themes in Unitarian Universalist theology, this is number 6. Today's topic is ecclesiology. Ecclesiology has to do with the nature, structure, and purpose of a religious community, what we do and how we are governed. In earlier topics in this series, we have considered whether human beings are good or evil, what salvation means, and how the world will come to an end. Those are themes that drive blockbuster action movies. Ecclesiology, on the other hand, is a theme which generates term papers in graduate school. Yet, how and why a faith tradition does what it does has everything to do with how we live together. Our tradition uses congregational governance, also known as congregational polity. This goes back to the 1630s, to the Calvinist congregational churches of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Those Puritan churches were the congregations out of which the heresy of Unitarian theology would emerge in the 1800s. If you drive through towns in Massachusetts or surf the web to look at UU churches out there, you will see some very early dates. You may see a church signboard that says, for example, First Church of Cambridge gathered on February 1, 1636. Gathered. This is how a church was formed, by people coming together. It wasn't planted or decreed by a bishop or a hierarchy, but gathered by people making a covenant to travel together in fellowship and affection. Some UUs are shocked to hear that we owe our form of governance to Puritans. I was too. To be sure, the Puritans were not perfect ancestors, assuming anybody has perfect ancestors. Church matters were decided by discussion and by vote, yes, but only men could vote. Moreover, they followed the ugly Calvinist beliefs of a vengeful God, an eternal hell, and total human depravity. The Puritans didn't like the Quakers, so they persecuted them. They didn't like the Baptists either, and they chased them out of Massachusetts. And worst of all, as white settlers living by the doctrine of white supremacy, the Puritans felt it was their God-given right to take over native lands and to murder many native people in the process. So we cannot idealize these ancestors or overlook their sins. Yet their form of governance for churches to be independent was a radical idea. They had been bruised by Catholic and royal suppression of the Protestant Reformation in England and Europe. So they distrusted top-down structures and hierarchies, bishops and popes. They devised that a congregation's members would make decisions together about their future as a congregation. At the other end of the spectrum from congregational independence is the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church. Every Catholic parish belongs to a diocese, and it is the bishop of the diocese who sets major policies for his parishes and selects the priests to serve the parishes and directs their social justice messages. Bishops are appointed by the Pope and accountable to him. Many faith communities, many traditions fall somewhere in between these two ends of the spectrum, which are governance by the local congregation and ownership and control by a larger hierarchy. Every structure has its benefits and its weaknesses. Though our UU congregations are independent, they are not alone. We in UUSS here are connected to the other 1,040 congregations in this country through the UUA, or the Unitarian Universalist Association. Through our participation at business meetings at the UUA General Assembly and our annual donations to support the UUA's programs and services, we live out our covenant with all the other congregations. Covenant is a significant feature of our UU movement. It comes from our heritage. A covenant is a set of promises that people make to each other. James Luther Adams was a major theologian, a UU theologian of the 20th century. He said that covenants are crucial in human relationships and institutions. He said that of all species, human beings are the promise-making, promise-breaking, and promise-renewing animals. We are the promise-making, promise-breaking, and promise-renewing animals. In a community based on covenant, we keep learning and trying to live together. We practice learning how to make a place for ourselves and to make space for others. Guided by a covenant, we will experience disappointment and frustration with one another, but we can learn to extend forgiveness and start over. We learn to practice patience. To have a covenant is to say we have faith in one another. Together we can discern a way forward. This faith underlies the fourth principle of the current seven principles of our UU Association. The fourth principle says we affirm and promote the use of the democratic process in our congregations and in society at large. The democratic process takes a different form in a UU congregation than it has in secular politics. Rarely will you see two candidates running for a church position, debating and campaigning to prove which one is the better one to be the board secretary or treasurer or president or vice president or any other role. Most of the time, we rely on the spiritual practice of discernment. We elect a nominating committee. We entrust them with the role of recruiting members who are able and ready to serve in an elected position. Those members themselves discern if it's the right fit for them or the right time for them to serve in elected leadership. Of course, our UUSS Constitution does allow for somebody to run by petition, so it is possible to have a contested election. It's also possible for the nominating committee to create a contested election, but it rarely happens. We operate on a constitution, bylaws, and a set of policies here at UUSS. Ultimately, though, our progress depends on our trust in one another. One example of the work of discernment is the strategic plan the congregation developed in 2018. In contrast to having a quick vote to choose between detailed proposals already made, we had a series of forums and meetings. We invited as many people to participate as were able and interested. In any process of discernment, we don't know all the outcomes in advance. We don't even know all the possibilities in advance in a process of discernment. The possibilities emerged in our meetings. We brought people together to think, imagine, ask questions, and listen to one another. Our members would flesh out goals that felt relevant for these times and which felt congruent with our mission. Not until we had refined the goals and had more conversations did our members take a formal vote to adopt the plan. It was unanimous. Now we are working faithfully to implement our plan. Even so, we don't know all the ideas and opportunities that might emerge in our discernment along the way to help us live into that plan. Speaking of decision-making, speaking of voting, the UU minister and consultant and author Dan Hotchkiss has strong advice for congregations. When making votes, He asks all of us to think about the people that our choices will affect, but who can't vote. In other words, he says, remember the people of our congregation's future who are not here to vote now, the people who haven't found us yet. The decisions we make in the present will shape the future experience of adults and children who have not yet become part of this congregation. In her book, Salsa, Soul, and Spirit, Juana Bordas writes that organizational activists and leaders in communities of color make it a practice to be mindful of the coming generations as they do their work in the present moment. They keep the long view. An example of this is the Iroquois Nation's classic reminder to consider the effects of a decision on the children of the next seven generations. If we affirm the kinship of all people, we must consider those people who are yet to come. In a faith based on covenant, we can practice learning how to make a place for ourselves and make space for others. Furthermore, our discernment should extend beyond humanity. It should take into consideration the natural world. Benny Shendo is a leader of the Jemez Pueblo Indians and a former official in the state of New Mexico. Looking at politics in the dominant culture, Shendo says, when a person is elected to office, he is responsible, in a sense, to the people who voted for him. But eagles don't vote. The trees don't vote. The buffalo don't vote. And the waters don't vote. Contrary to expectations in traditional politics, he says, one who serves as a leader of the Jemez Pueblo Indians has to be responsible for the community, for the future, and for the natural world in which all people live. When people think of a church, what often comes to mind is a building. Moments ago, Karen told us of her vivid memories of the small wooden church of her childhood in Idaho. We saw images on the screen of our building here as our chalice singers offered a song. That song was the song our choir had sung back in 2015 at the dedication of this building, or the rededication of this building after the renovation and expansion. Yet in our ecclesiology, a church is not a building. It is a group of people who come together for shared purposes. For example, the First Unitarian Church of Sacramento was founded in 1868 by 17 families in Sacramento. However, as a congregation, we existed without our own meeting space until 1915. And then we built a lovely home in Midtown. We settled in there until we outgrew it. And then in 1960, we built this building and moved out here. When we vacated this space in 2014 for the renovation and expansion of this building, we rented space at a congregational church about a mile from here. We took our hymnals, our piano, our name tag racks, our offering baskets, and our coffee. And we were in that other church building every Sunday for 13 months. Even so, new people found us there, and many of them joined us. In 2015, when we returned here, many UUSS members were encountering this building for the first time. A congregation may have a building, but it is not a building. Ministers often visit people in distressing circumstances, in the intensive care unit, or a skilled nursing facility, or a prison, or a detention facility of the Federal Immigration Agency. When clergy make such a pastoral visit, it is often said that we represent the divine. That is, our presence reflects the care of God for the person in distress. This common perception may be comforting, and that's good. However, when I visit somebody, I have a stronger sense that I am representing this congregation. I have the idea that you are sending me there as a representative of your collective care and compassion. You might say that I am taking you into the room with me. Is that okay? But this concept is not limited to clergy. We have a volunteer pastoral visitors team here as well. And of course, there are many others of you who make unofficial visits all the time to support people who have become your friends through this church. When you are showing kindness to someone, when you offer an open mind and heart, you represent this congregation's compassion. When Reverend Lucy or I meet with people who wish to join UUSS as official members, we show them a variety of materials. The new strategic plan, a list of our staff members, but we start with a colorful chart, the organizational chart for UUSS. Guess who is listed in the box at the top of the chart? If you said the congregation, that's right. It is the members who have ultimate authority. They elect lay leaders to their offices. They approve the annual budget. We tell these new members, when you join UUSS, you become a stakeholder. You get a voice and a vote. And you get some ethical responsibilities. What I mean is, this congregation employs and pays a number of people to serve it. It is a neighbor in this local area. It has buildings and a large campus to be maintained and cared for. Our members bear a shared responsibility for mortgage debt for this building, and we have some investments to oversee. So it is all the members together who do their part in steering the ship we call a Unitarian Universalist congregation. But who owns this ship? Who owns the church? I already said it's not the denomination. Isn't the point of my sermon that the voting members own the church? But maybe it's the board members and other elected leaders who own the ship, at least as long as they have terms of office. Is that it? Or what about the funders? Those people whose donations, pledges, and offerings fund our mission and our ministries. Maybe they own it. Or what about those long departed who bequeathed a lot of money to the congregation? They cared about it and cared about what it was doing. Maybe it belongs to them. Dan Hotchkiss, the UU minister who is a church consultant, says, not quite. Not really. Dan imagines a different owner and invites us to imagine a different owner. He says that a thriving and vital congregation is one that belongs to its mission. It is our mission which guides us and calls us forward. The mission helps us to measure our choices when we have new ideas or when we have difficult hurdles. The mission inspires our gifts of time, talent, and financial support. The current mission statement of this congregation was developed about 20 years ago through a process of discernment and then adopted by vote. We come together to deepen our lives and be a force for healing in the world. The first phrase is the most important part. We come together. It's also the part that reminds us of our roots in those early congregations in the 1600s. We come together. That is the start. Everything else unfolds from that great gift. If you are a member or thinking about being a member. If you are participating here, you are a steward of our mission and our ministries. You are a provider and a receiver of gifts. Your presence here will change this congregation, and your participation will change you. It will shape you. In Karen's story about growing up in Idaho, she told us how life in a congregation formed her, shaped her as a child. The formative role of a spiritual community on us probably is more obvious when we can recall experiences in it as a young person. It may be more subtle to see how it's shaping us in our adulthood. So I invite you in the coming days to take some time to consider how this place has formed you or shaped you, shaped your identity, your outlook, your commitments, your spiritual grounding, your sense of belonging to something larger than yourself. All of my UU communities have done those things for me. They have shaped my values, given me courage and guidance, and made me feel known and cared for. How does this congregation shape your experience as a human being? As we often say, our UU tradition does not have a creed. This congregation doesn't have a creed. There is no uniform statement of beliefs which you must agree to in order to become a member or participate in the congregation. In the words of minister and UU historian Alice Blair Wesley, what joins us together is not a uniform statement of belief, but a shared sense of loyalty. Loyalty to the community, loyalty to the mission, loyalty to the future, to those who haven't found us yet, loyalty to all who live and suffer beyond these walls, loyalty to the web of life that holds us all. In these troubled and confusing times, I think that loyalty, courage, and a sense of belonging matter now more than they ever did. In this community, we are joined by our loyalties and by our loves, our loyalties to shared values, to the congregation, and to the common good. We come together. That is the start. Everything else unfolds from that great gift. May we be grateful. Blessed be, and amen.